So, Matthew chapter 5, as you might remember, if you've been around in the last few weeks, has had Jesus clarifying for us the particulars of what the law of God means in practice. Now, that's very helpful for quite a lot of us who are trying to truly follow the path of discipleship. But I'm sure you will have heard the words that we've heard over the last few weeks from Matthew chapter 5, particularly challenging. I know I have. And so some of you might well have reflected that you're not actually living up to them, that you're not living this life of discipleship as Christ has called us. Or you might have thought, well, those things are all easy. I do those things before breakfast. And if you think like that, I want to meet you after the service because I think you must be a very special person. So most of us, I think, will have been challenged over the last few weeks. And I'm going to warn you that it's not going to get much easier tonight, that now we're moving on to chapter 6. Because tonight we're going to look at that God is not calling us just to do certain things, but he's also looking at our insides as well, the inward inclinations that we are living for God. So to allow us time to reflect on that topic, this idea of the inward, how working from the inside out, if you like, we're looking at some very important indicators to the Jewish community of that time that they were living a holy life, the ones that we've heard just now, giving to the poor, and fasting. And we're going to look at those tonight, and see what those things mean for us living as 21st century disciples. Now, Jesus' original listeners would have wanted to do those things, fasting and giving, to be holy, or certainly to appear holy. But Jesus always likes to encourage people, both those people then and people now, to go further. Using our jargon, he wants to take them out of their comfort zone. So that's why addressing what should be happening at our hearts and minds while we're doing these holy acts, that's the stretch that Jesus is calling for us. So as I say, Jesus isn't making things easier. So the underlying theme is about our mindset when we do good works. And it's saying that what actions we do should not be done in a way that draws attention to ourselves, or God will not reward us. So we're going to start by looking at the first part of the readings tonight. So in 6 verse 1 it says, and I'll read from the New Revised Standard Version, which is a slightly different translation than you heard just now. By practicing your piety before others in order to be seen by them, for then you have no reward from your Father in heaven. So the New Revised Standard Version translates the Greek word as piety rather than righteousness. Now that's a translation that's a bit more in line with common English usage, but it loses that connection between this passage and the broader message of the Sermon on the Mount. Righteousness is the basic subject of the entire Sermon on the Mount. Righteousness is required to enter the kingdom of heaven. So the rest of that passage that we heard this evening is part of the broader description of righteousness, which underlines, as I say, the sermon. And when we move on to verse 2, Jesus starts talking to us about giving to the poor, which is a fundamental part of what it means to be a follower of God. Jesus wants to make sure that we understand how not to give and how to give. The message is straightforward enough, but it still presents a challenge when applied. Jesus' principle about how to give, what we might call God-centered giving, is that it's most easily transferable to our modern situation. But that makes it somehow the most challenging for us. It was then, and is now, commonly seen as a reasonable reward for those who provide charitable gifts to be honoured by having their names associated with their contributions. We can look around at lots of churches, maybe stained glass windows with a plaque underneath, or schools, or plenty of institutions, public institutions, and see that they're littered with the names of the people who have given the money to provide that. Now, in defence of this practice, the argument can be made that not allowing this would decrease the level of giving to worthwhile causes. But if we are willing to say that it would decrease the level of giving, is that not the very hypocrisy which Jesus is referring to here? Our society might understandably be impressed with such grand, seemingly selfless acts, but God apparently is not. When Jesus calls on his disciples not to make a show of their religion, he's very clearly is not saying, don't give to the needy, but he's saying don't give to the needy to gain praise of others. And if we ignore this warning, then we will get the praise of others, the praise of society. But what is performed in secret receives God's reward. To make this point, it says in verse 2, so when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. Now there's a discussion about what exactly Jesus means when he says, don't sound a trumpet. So special festivals were perhaps proclaimed with the sounding of a trumpet, and so that was a good time to make a show of your generosity to the poor. Now, some commentators say that there genuinely was a trumpet at that point. There was an actual trumpet that was sounded to indicate that it was time for people to give their money to the poor, and the community would come to the temple to receive financial aid. People would come to the poor would come to get the contributions, and the rich would come to give them. Other commentators say that it refers to this type of collection bin for the money. And there was apparently, some people say, there was a trumpet-shaped metal cone, if you can imagine that, that funneled into the collection box and narrowed the opening into the box so that people couldn't put their hand in and create some money out. And people quite liked that, if that was how it happened, because when they put their money in, they would do it with lots of clinks because it would make noise spiraling down the funnel, and that everyone around them would have thought, oh, look at how much money that person's giving. There are lots of clinks there. And I suppose now, because quite a lot of us give our money through the contactless machine, we would have to turn up the beeping very loud when we had the contactlessness to recreate that. But what Jesus is saying here is, don't do that. Don't draw attention to the fact that you're giving money. Don't sound the trumpet. Jesus says that the people who do this are hypocrites. Now, the root of the word hypocrite refers to the actors in Greek and Roman culture. In other words, a hypocrite is someone who acts like one thing, but is actually something else. So these are people who act like they're holy, like they're righteous. They act as if they were followers of God, but in reality, they're not. They're hypocrites. Jesus then says they will have their reward. So what is their reward? Now, some people suggest that Jesus is merely being sarcastic at that point and saying, when he's saying, oh, they'll have their reward, that he's really meaning there won't be a reward for them. But we could take it another way. We could say that they do have a reward, the hypocrites do get a reward, but it's a far less reward than God would give them. They get the approval of human society. They get their name on this big plaque in the buildings or underneath the stained glass windows. And they will get approval for that. But that is nothing compared to the reward that they would get from God if they did it in secret. So the praise of society, recognitions, names written on a list and on plaques, all those things will one day pass away. However, the rewards of God are eternal and everlasting. The right motive for giving is compassion, which starts from the heart and for the recipient's benefit, irrespective of the onlookers. For the reward, perfect righteousness is always rewarded. But more about the giving itself. The kind of giving discussed in this passage is not the same thing as our offering given in worship, even if a portion of that offering is given to assist those who are struggling. The sort of giving referred to here entails a personal and direct act of doing good for those in need. It's something done over and above one's regular offering to the church. It cannot be delegated to others because it's an essential aspect of that is giving is what's happening in our hearts. This giving is not authentic unless it's done with a personal, heartfelt caring for those in need. And as we have said, it's not real giving if it's done with a sense of superiority or for the approval of others. God-centered giving is founded on the conviction that all things come from God and all wealth is never our personal possession, but belongs to God, given to us in trust, to be used for our good and for the good of the world. So when we give, we're not giving away our wealth. It is us sharing our wealth, the wealth which was entrusted to us by God, and sharing it with those who God wants to have a share in the wealth of the world. and for the followers of Jesus is the most profound way in which we can meet Jesus in the here and now. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. As a spiritual practice, this type of giving also has a possibility of shedding light on our own unseen inner poverty. How do your feelings about the poor and needy impact your relationship with God? For example, if we have feelings of resentment, lack of generosity, or alienation towards people who are struggling, can we truly have feelings of thanksgiving, generosity, and intimacy with God? Authentic giving may have the unexpected blessing of bringing inner joy and peace to our impoverished hearts. So let's pause for a moment and think a little bit about what Jesus says there as well. He says, when you give. He doesn't say if you give. Jesus has an expectation that the followers of God is that they will give. And Jesus is speaking specifically here about giving to the poor. And when we think about that, when we read about that, about the early church, when we go into Acts, we can see that giving took place through local churches. But as I just said a second ago, it's a kind of giving, though, that impacts on yourself. It's not just throwing a few coins into a bowl and then considering that's all you're doing. This is very resonant for us today. The Church of Scotland, as we all focus on a lot, is in a time of change. And for us to do more effective ministry, to reach a greater volume of ministry, and to reach out to our wider parish, unfortunately, I have to say to you, it's really centred on the fact that the church family need to give faithfully and sacrificially. Jesus says we're to give, though, in secret. We're not to make a big fuss. We're not to draw attention. We're not to act for recognition. But we're to give generously and sacrificially, but to do so humbly and quietly. If we do this, as Jesus says in verse 4, your Father who sees in secret will reward you. The rewards of God are so much richer, deeper, longer lasting, more soul satisfying, more fulfilling, and more valuable than the rewards of the world. God will remember your sacrifice and your giving, both to those in need and to the cause of Christ that cause Christ carried out through the local church. So to sum up, we're meant to make a heavenly investment and to do so secretly. Let's take a break for a few moments to ponder that as we lift our voices in song, as we sing our next hymn, make way for Christ the King. So if you thought those verses were challenging, which were about giving, prepare yourself, because we're now going to talk about fasting. We're going to focus on the verses 16, 17, and 18, which were the other verses we heard tonight separately. Now, as it's been a wee while since we just heard them, well, I know it was only a few moments ago, but it feels a wee while to me. I'll read you them again. When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Now, you'll hear, I'm sure, the same underlying theme that we've been thinking about in terms of giving, this idea that you do things secretly, you do things without making a big show of it. But we're applying it here to a possibly even more challenging spiritual discipline, a discipline around fasting. And one of the difficulties about talking about fasting is that fasting doesn't really have much meaning for most Christians today, at least in the West. Fasting was a common religious activity for Jews, but also for Christians in the ancient world, but not so today. Because of that, it seems hard for us to conceive of what reward Jesus could even have in mind here. Being recompensed by God for charitable giving, as we've just been talking about, has a certain sense to it. But what reward could we possibly get from God for fasting? In fact, when fasting is done today, it's usually done precisely to draw attention, admittedly not to the fasters, but to some worthwhile cause, such as world hunger. We'll come back and we'll look at that in a few minutes. So what can we make any sense of what Jesus is saying? I believe our problem is that in Western culture, we have managed to almost completely divorce spiritual practices from bodily ones. We so emphasize our inner heart and state of mind that it's hard for us to see any benefit from such a thoroughly bodily practice as fasting. For ancient people, there was no such tension. And so humbling oneself before God through abstention from food, or drink, or sleep, or sex, was a natural religious experience. In Jewish piety, fasting was used in association with confession, or some special prayer. In our text tonight, we see that the Jewish people had mastered the art of fasting. They had rituals around it. In the first century, they basically would fast on Mondays and Thursdays, in addition to the law's requirement that they fast on the Day of Atonement, and possibly at the New Year. Those Jewish people would have seemed extremely zealous to their community, as they kept themselves from eating anything from sunrise to sunset, one or two days a week. Fasting throughout the Bible always referring to abstaining from eating food. We'll talk later about other things we can abstain from, but in the Bible, fasting always refers to going without food specifically. And we see examples of fasting throughout the Old Testament in men and women like Moses or Hannah or David or Daniel or Esther or Nehemiah. These are righteous men and women, and they would refrain from eating, and so the Jews of Jesus' time wanted to follow in their footsteps. Jesus' Jewish contemporaries had made fasting a religious ritual that gave them good standing in their community. They fasted because that was what righteous people did, and they wanted to be recognized as extremely righteous so that they could have power and influence. As you've heard today in the verses we just heard a few moments ago, Jesus looks at their fasting critically. He says that they are fasting with faces that are disfigured, meaning that they are making sure everyone knows how difficult it is for them to go without food. Again, it's making a show of their piety. That's the problem. Fasting was taken into the Christian faith as an expression of self-discipline. Jesus obviously assumed that his disciples will fast, and after his departure, we hear him talk about that in Matthew 9, 14 to 17. We do see Christians fasting on specific occasions in the New Testament, but their fasting is never ritualized in the way that it was ritualized within the Jewish faith, because fasting is something that's done on special occasions. It wasn't commanded like singing and praying and giving as a regular part of worship. Now, we can understand that personally, because fasting seems to be an appropriate response to certain extreme situations in life. We might choose to fast when we lose someone we love, or when we have empathy for someone else, when we feel intense remorse about our sins, or when we're praying for God's help in making a big decision. So we don't want to ritualize fasting as the Jewish people had done, but we also don't want to altogether reject it, because Jesus seems to think that it has a benefit. Jesus says that God rewards fasting in secret, so clearly he thought it was something that had a worthwhile in doing. The one liturgical season of the year where Christians still have a tradition of some sort of fasting, I feel like I should say, if there were any children here, I would say, can you tell me? Can anyone think of that? What part of the liturgical year do we have something that's more akin to fast? Lent, well done. Now, that's always linked to fasting, but not starving. In that way, it's a way to purge the body, quieten the mind, and heighten spiritual awareness. It's an interesting idea, renouncing self so that we might be open to God through prayer and meditation. So Lent's not about denial as such. It's not about self-denial. It's about focusing our lives again on Christ. Lent is all about reflective prayer and meditation on the Word. This is where fasting fits in. It's a practical, and particularly it's in our overindulgent world, way to focus on, make sure that we're focusing on God. Of course, the danger is that these outward symbols of fasting, whether in Lent or at any point in the year, we end up doing exactly what Jesus warns us against. We might feel some outward pride if we're doing it in the way and that Jesus says very clearly not to do, but we're doing it in a very ostentatious way. Remember, the importance lies with the action of the heart rather than the external. So, does fasting have a place in Christian life today? When we see someone fasting today, as in giving up food for a period of time, they might well be doing it because it's a popular thing to do. They might not be doing it for Christian reasons at all. We live in a society that has no shortage of food for most people. People fast to lose weight or sometimes to save some money, for example. Now, those methods of fasting are not are purely focused on ourselves. They often have no spiritual aspect whatsoever. But looking at a more Christian approach to fasting, what benefit is there in giving up something for a short while, especially something like food? In Western society, it's activists rather than religious communities who have been at the forefront of recovering what we might call traditional fasting. It's a way of reconnecting the personal and the political. At its best, it is very directly hungering and thirsting for the right of the world, putting your body, our bodies, on the line. As such, personal and group abstention has been a part of the campaign for the remission of global debt burden on the poor. It has strengthened the pro-democracy monks in Burma. It has featured on protests outside asylum detention centres. The value of fasting, though, is little comprehended these days. No doubt those who hold a dismissive view of things spiritual will be tempted to see it as merely punitive self-abuse for the gullible. Rightly understood, though, fasting is a life-changing practice of self-examination and social reorientation. It embodies, quite literally, the liberating discovery that we human beings are not simply the sum total of our appetites, but have been given the capacity to transcend self in solidarity with those who are denied food and justice. It reaches beyond material satisfaction towards the kind of transformative love that is beyond limited or tribal affections. Fasting is therefore an integrative discipline focused on how we think with our bodies, not with our disembodied, unaffected mind. Human consciousness and decision-making is inextricably linked up with us being our relational creatures, dependent, rational animals, as the moral philosopher Alistair MacIntyre puts it. There is genuine freedom in this. And if we learn it by it, by exploring and directing our yearnings and actions personally and corporately, not by theory alone. In a vociferously consumer society, where luxuries rather than necessities are the preoccupation of the many, fasting also has a certain political poignancy. When the quest to possess and devour more and more takes over, our personal and social priorities are fundamentally altered. Instead, fasting points us in the direction of sharing and the otherwise unimaginable politics of enough. As a distinctly spiritual practice with broad roots, fasting also readily connects with secular initiatives like Buy Nothing Day and grassroots attempts to resist our consumerist culture. What people are learning through hungering for justice is that trying to come up with policies for politics for a better world is not enough. We need to change people to want them, to make them work. But that involves reshaping our desires, not just our political hopes. But going without food, even if you're doing it for reasons such as these, is not the only way you can fast. The key thing is to give up something that you hunger for every day. For example, a glass of wine, some chocolate, watching TV, constantly checking your email, looking at the internet, whatever you feel you can't do without. But then we have to ask ourselves, why should we deny ourselves? What's the point of that kind of fasting, that kind of denial? Now, I think fasting is important for two reasons. First, when we fast, we actually pause and we experience our hunger, our need. Doesn't matter if it's hunger, as in hunger for food. You can have many different kinds of hunger. We then, if we pause, get to reflect on the hungers that drive our life. Just exactly why is it we're so busy doing what we do? What we need, what hunger, is so important that we are literally dying by giving our time, our life for it. Is this the way we seek to satisfy or avoid our hungers actually working? We need food to live. We need shelter and safety and love and accomplishment. But sometimes we get locked in patterns that actually undermine what we're trying to achieve. For example, getting so far into debt that life becomes a rat race. We are so frazzled that relationships fray and joy turns to ashes. Fasting, giving up something you need, and I'm putting inverted commas around that, breaks the pattern, gives time for reflecting and deeper awareness, and opens the possibility for new choices. But even more importantly, when we fast, we're invited to experience a deeper awareness of our hunger for God. Perhaps we have confused our hunger for God with something else. Food, shelter, safety, love, accomplishments, even life itself, are all good, but they're all temporary. Perhaps we have been neglecting the one and true, only, truly eternal source of joy and peace. As Jesus once said, it takes more than bread to really live. That's the message, you know, the Message translation. That's the Message translation of Luke chapter 4, verse 4. It takes more than bread to really live. When we fast, we have the opportunity to reorientate our impulses and our daily living so that we enjoy the delight of good bread, the delight of our good God. In Isaiah chapter 58, though, God says, They seek me daily and delight to know my ways as if they were a nation that did righteousness and did not forsake judgment of their God. Now, when we see the Jews in the Old Testament in verses such as this, it's essential to remember those were extremely religious people. They were focused on being religious and doing all kinds of good spiritual thing. They say, again, it's a quote from the passage, "Why have we fasted and you see it not? Why have we humbled ourselves and you take no acknowledgement of it?" But God says, "Behold, in the day you fast, you seek your own pleasure and oppress all your workers." The same idea is given in Zechariah chapter 7, verse 8, when God asks, "Is it for me that you fast?" He would rather they love justice and show mercy than fast because their fasting is all about their own self-righteousness. God is not interested in having religious people who do all kinds of zealous works for God while rebelling against his commandments to love their neighbor. So I want to leave you this evening with an even more radical thought about what constitutes true fasting. It is certainly about more than going without food. I think it's about connecting with reality and noticing the suffering of your neighbor. Most of the time, we try to make reality fit our preferences and our self-directed hopes. But the Spirit will not leave us in peace with our own version of reality. The Spirit brings us into God's world, God's frame of reference. When we say that Jesus was filled with the Spirit, what we mean is that Jesus lives every moment in God's world, not in the confused muddle of fears and hopes and self-serving preferences that the rest of us inhabit for so much of our lives. And when that reality is uncovered, what do we see in the world when we are living in God's frame of reference? We see a world where people are not free, where they are denied a future, where they themselves cannot enjoy a truthful and hopeful vision of things. Our selfishness and untruthfulness can have the effect of blocking out vision for other people and leaving them in the dark, unable to grasp their choices and the possibility they actually have. So the Spirit is the power that brings liberty to prisoners and sight to those who cannot see. And we who live in the Spirit are committed to that agenda, to that vision of hope. The prophet Isaiah speaks of the fast that God wants. And we can understand this a bit better in the perspective of this vision of the Spirit. "Real fasting," says God to the prophet, "is breaking the bonds of injustice and sharing your resources. And this is fasting because it means denying yourself something. Not denying yourself material things alone, or even denying yourself food in the usual sort of religious fasting, but denying yourself the pleasures of thinking of yourself as isolated, as an isolated being with no real relations to those around you. Denying yourself the fantasy that you can live in this and organize the world to suit yourself. Denying yourself the luxury of not noticing the suffering of your neighbor. This is fasting, but something that reconnects us with reality. And in that context, the context of the gospel, this is the fasting that the Holy Spirit makes possible for us, breaking through our self-satisfaction. When we pray for justice for the poor and for the whole of our material environment, we're really praying for the gift of the Spirit to open our eyes and help us to fast, to turn away from the unhealthy diet of falsehood. And let's all pray that from today, this is the kind of fast that we can hold to every day.